Radio St. Pete presents Typewriter Talks with Maureen McDowell, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit.
Hello, welcome to Typewriter Talks. This podcast features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. My name is Maureen McDowell, and I'm the founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. On Typewriter Talks, we discuss all kinds of writerly topics, hoping to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Today, we are happy to welcome Bill DeYoung. Bill was born in St. Petersburg and spent the first 21 years of his life here. After a long time living in other cities, working at newspapers, and learning how to write on a deadline, he came back to his hometown in 2014 and now spends most of his time wondering where the city he loved so much disappeared to. He is a senior writer and editor for the St. Pete Catalyst and has written 6 books, the most recent of which is Vintage St. Pete and Pinellas, Volume 3. Welcome, Bill.
Hey, how are you, Maureen?
Good. Thank you for being patient with me, Bill. And we had to reschedule this a couple times. We did not have Typewriter Talks last week because, as you can hear, I had a chest cold and I lost my voice. And now it's coming back. But
you feeling better now?
Yes, I'm on the mend. But
great, good to
hear. It was quite an adventure to lose your voice when you're a writer and a talker.
So
tell us what you're working on right now.
Well, right now, just focusing on Catalyst work, and Vintage St. Pete and Pinellas Volume 3 just came out, and we're kind of looking towards, frankly, the holiday season and how to get it in people's hands. It literally has been out for maybe 10 days.
That's so exciting. How do you feel about it?
I'm really pleased with this book, this being the third volume. I actually designed this book myself for the first time, and I designed the cover too. So it really kind of checks all the boxes for everything I wanted these books to be. There are a few things about they're full of wonderful stories. Of course, the first two, there were some things about the design that I wasn't crazy about. They look great, but I fixed it all this time. So I'm happy about that.
So are you going to re-release the earlier editions? You can always, are they print on demand? No, they're hardcover, so they're not print.
Well, the first one, the volume one, the hardcover sold out, and it wasn't done on print on demand. So
congratulations.
You know, 800 of them, and they sold out. It's amazing. So then now there is a softbound print on demand. The second one, which didn't do nearly as well, but like the sophomore effort, I think is really pretty worthy. You know, it's like Hootie and the Blowfish or something. Nobody cared about their second record, but this was my second record. And anyway, so that hasn't gone to softbound yet because we haven't sold all hardbacks. Whereas this this new one is available in both.
So this podcast is actually being listened to all over the world, believe it or not. So explain to our listeners exactly where the idea for Vintage St. Pete came about.
Well, I came back to my hometown in 2014, as you said, after a long time away. And it didn't take me sort of long to figure out that the St. Petersburg that I knew and loved was either gone or disappearing fast. As you know, as a fellow native, it doesn't look anything like it did, say, in the 60s or the 70s or even the 80s or 90s, really. So, you know, I'm an inveterate reader and researcher, so I would look up things that I remembered and never really found anything worth reading about it. You know, the Boyd Hill Nature Trail Zoo that I remembered as a kid, or what was the real story of the HMS Bounty that was moored here for all those years downtown, you know. So as a journalist, you know, questions drive you crazy, and so logically what you do is you try and answer them, and you try and answer them in a way that you can write it for other people who may have the same questions. That's where this started. There are 22 stories in the first book, 22 in the second book, and 25 in this one, which is a total of 69 now, and I've already written 4 more since this book came out. Lots of aspects of everyday life in St. Petersburg that haven't really been covered anywhere. And I just find it fascinating. I'll talk to people whose parents worked at Tiki Gardens I found the guy in his 70s, Rob Stambaugh, a wonderful guy, whose father ran the London Wax Museum. and Rob worked there as a kid, you know. So you always find some kind of connection to the present day. And yeah, it goes back to even long before you or I were born. I found things in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s that were long gone before I was ever born, but just fascinating things. And that's what these books are full of. Try to make them entertaining and, you know, not too long.
But it's also a cool idea for like people that are living in other cities that want to like really explore this.
Well, I hope so. I think that the audience, first and foremost, is probably people who live through it. You know, there are so many groups on social media, on Facebook, of people who either used to live here or still do, but remember the good old days, you know. And when these stories get posted, I get millions of comments. Oh my God, I remember Gabe Lade's roller rink. I remember Dr. Paul Bearer.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I used to go to the Beaux Arts Coffee House and art gallery, and or the Festival of States Parade, which is that's what's on the cover of this new one, which they did for more than 100 years. The Festival of States was a huge thing.
Yeah,
every
yeah, was
you remember
thing.
Of course you did.
Yeah.
Gone. And so those people remember that and go, oh yeah, you
well,
know.
And cool,
and I also, for people who are new here, want to know what life was like before we became, you know, oh my God, a tech center and all the things that we
yeah right
about.
I live in the innovation district now.
Yeah,
I'm in Roser Park.
Oh, like, Roser Park's the interface. Oh, yeah,
it's in that area. Like they're even naming the condos that they're putting up like Innovate or something like Innovare. No, it's Innovare is the name. Innovare.
It's just not the same. And you know, all that stuff is just, it's just gone. And I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, it's such a shame. Progress sucks. You know, that's not the point of this. It's like, let's remember it and celebrate it. And if you didn't live through it and don't have any memory of it, learn about it. It might interest you to know that in the 1970s, for example, the highest form of entertainment in St. Petersburg, which never really had a performing arts center, was dinner theater. With the
Showboat
old
dinner theater. Yep, I remember.
Yeah, the Showboat Dinner Theater and the Country Dinner Playhouse in the mall, where you had like TV stars from the 60s and pretty much everybody from the Brady Bunch in later years, if you follow me, would come and do a play. They'd come do Boing Boing or Come Blow Your Horn or something, you know. The cast, there was a lot of Gilligan's Island people, you know, and that was what you got dressed up to do in those days. That's all there was.
Yeah.
I found that just utterly fascinating, and found so many incredible pictures and people to tell me stories about it.
Yeah.
So that's what that's the long answer to the short question, which is what are these books about?
But I love that, like, your whole writing career, knowing you for a while, is really you just following your curiosity as a musician. And then now this is like, these are just stories that you were curious to write about. What a gift.
You know, the first book I wrote, as you probably know, was the story of the Sunshine Skyway Bridge disaster. It's 10 years old this year. It's called Skyway, folks. It's on Amazon. And that was the same thing. I was living in Savannah, Georgia at the time, and some anniversary came up, and I noticed it online. I went looking to read about it, and every other story said something different than the story before it. And that just annoyed me as a journalist. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Some of these people are still alive, and I can get all the legal paperwork. I can get the transcripts from the trial. I can get all the insurance documents. And I did. It's like, okay, I want, you know, that's what it is, Maureen. I wanted to read it.
Yeah.
So it turned out I had to write it. And that
I think that's a really good motto as a creative. Like, if you're not getting your needs met, I mean, that's why I started Keep St. Pete Lit.
Yeah, exactly right. Same thing.
Yeah. As a reader and writer. And we tend to think like, you know, feel the dreams. If you build it, they will come. Well, hopefully.
I'm still, you know, I still got a closet full of volume twos that I'm trying to sell.
Well,
at least we got this one out before the holidays. It's the first time that's happened. So we're.
But tell us what a typical day looks like for you as a writer.
I get up pretty early. And generally I have one or either two stories, art stories in the Catalyst every day, 6 days a week. And I pretty much always write them the afternoon or the evening before. So when I get up early and get my coffee, I just put them out. And the rest of the day is spent either, you know, working on what's coming next, or not either, but working on what's coming next. And also I'm the content editor for the Catalyst. So the stories that Veronica and Mark and whoever else is writing for us are writing the news and business stories. I'm the one who edits the copy. So when you find a typo, folks, blame me, because it happens, you know, but hopefully not too many. And yeah, it's just kind of keeping, you know, parts of the website maintained and things like Craig Pittman's podcast. I have to process all of that stuff. And, you know, I'm kind of Joe Hamilton's, you know, I don't want to say right-hand man. That's not what I am, but I'm kind of the utility guy to get things online on the site.
So how has your writing process changed over the years?
I think I'm a lot more obsessive than I used to be. You know, as a journalist, you just, I hate the way it sounds, but you just crank it out. You know, I was the arts editor in Gainesville for, I think, 18 or 20 years, which means I put out that Friday art magazine every week for 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, and that's juggling a whole stable of writers, mostly correspondents and stuff that I had to write, and the layout people that you have to deal with, and the guy designing the cover. And you just learn how to do it on a dime because you have to. Now I think I have more of a luxury where I can take a little time, especially with these vintage stories. They take a little while. You know, there's a little work involved, little research, and it's very rewarding at the end. I think, you know, the thing is too, that the art stories that I do for the Catalyst, you know, I'm very proud of I'm, frankly, I'm very proud of what I do there, but sometimes I can turn them out pretty fast because that's just my training. I've been doing it since I was in my 20s.
Yeah. It's
and
wild.
You know what? I haven't been in my 20s for quite a while.
Well, it's wild to be interviewed by you because it's really just this like very casual conversation. And then you just like, you just know exactly how to get, you know, it doesn't feel clinical. Some journalism feels clinical almost. Yours is always very humanist.
That's a high compliment. One of the things that I always tell, you know, writers that I work with is if you're not in the moment, if you're not with the person you're interviewing and you don't have the facts that you need before you start getting another job, you know, that you have to be all over it. You know, I went last night to the Off Central to see No Exit in a dress rehearsal. I had already written the story with Alan Mooney, the director. I'm very familiar with that play, but I wanted to see it, you know, then I came home last night from seeing it. And I changed some stuff in the story I'd written. I put it out this morning. And so, you know, live it, I guess, is the thing, you know, don't just talk the, what is it? Talk the talk. You got to walk the walk. I don't know, whatever that stupid saying is, that's what you do. You got to live it.
Yeah. It's also your energy too. Whenever you have interviewed me in the past, I'm like, be careful what you say. Don't say too much.
Well, it doesn't happen that often. Sometimes what I tell people, and I probably told you this too, was, you know, if there are mistakes made, they're usually going to be me. I'm going to stumble over something or pronounce somebody's name wrong, and then I'll stop it. But I'm the one who edits it, so I can go cut it out later.
You're very respectful too. You're very respectful, which is nice. You're not after like the, you know, the zing or the, you know. You honor the person that you're interviewing. You're not just trying to pump.
Hey, Maureen, the check's in the mail. Thanks for all this.
You're welcome.
It's just that's the only, you know, it's the only way to do it. You know, you're writing, you're talking about that person and what they do. It's not about you. It's not about being the best in the job or the best in town or whatever. It's about that moment, that story, that interview, and how do you get it across to other people?
Yeah,
that's all it is.
And you don't come in with like these, you got lists of questions in your head, but you really let the conversation lead the interview. You don't.
So,
you
know. Sometimes they're ridiculous places.
I know it's always amusing to be interviewed with you.
Well, you're very kind. Well, amusing is a good word. I'll take that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's all part of it though, because the conversation can go in different ways and you want to have a little bit of the intuition in. You don't want it to be all left brain. You want to have some of the right brain and the creativity to come in when you're having a conversation with people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's really good. So good. So tell us what would you tell your younger writer self?
Take pills for anxiety. Yeah, you know, I know. I think that my younger writer self thought he was hot shit for about 15 minutes, and I'd like to say, well, you know what? You know, raising my children was the most important thing I ever did when I thought I was hot shit then. But you know, I'd say slow down. That's what it is. Slow down and don't worry so much. Just, you know, keep your eyes on the prize. Keep your eyes on what's real.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. That I think when we're younger, we think it has to be flash in the pan and instant success, but like the long game, the slow and steady is really the way to go. I
Well, I
think
was a
it's
music writer, you
creative.
know. I for all of the 1980s, for example, and probably half the 90s before I wised up, I thought I was going to go to Los Angeles and work for a music label and be a publicist for a label. That's how out of touch I was, you know. And I they would have eaten me alive, and I wouldn't be here today, you know. And I wouldn't be celebrating the glory that is and was St. Petersburg, Florida, which I'm very, very proud to do.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you have, are you going to do a, you're working on a volume four of Vintage St. Pete, right?
Well, you know, I've done four, as I said, four stories. One of them was about your grandfather,
Woo-hoo!
Wilson Hubbard. And so if there's ever a volume four, God knows, you know, that'll be in there for sure. And yeah, it's just, you know, I ran out of tourist attractions, I think. But I'll tell you know, after the first one came out, people would say, well, you know, there's this thing called the Florida Wildlife Ranch in the on 4th Street that had like 15-foot alligators, and it closed in 59. It closed the year after I was born. So things keep coming up that I had no idea ever even existed. You know, I just wrote a story about the St. Petersburg alligator farm. They literally just tore the building down last week. It was built in 1917, but there was no trace of it for, you know, it closed in oh my God, 1940. You know,
Wow.
so that was a real sort of archaeological dig. And I want to give a shout out to Robert Blackman, who's the one that texted me and said, hey, there's construction fence around the old alligator farm building. It looks like they're going to tear it down, which is why I hopped on it. Because, you know, he's very eagle-eyed, you know, driving down there around Coffee Pot and or not Coffee Pot, Kokanikee, where he lives. You know, he found that old gas station. And, you know, I wrote the first story about that. And, you know, so I mean, the guy who ran the St. Petersburg alligator farm was a shoe manufacturer from Massachusetts, and who moved down here because his wife was ill. I guess they moved down for the weather, and somehow started an alligator farm. In those days, every city had one. Tampa had one. Clearwater had one. There's one in Largo. There's a big one in Sarasota. They had a skin hide business out the back end. But on the property, they had pens full of huge alligators, and it was a big thing in those days. The big story about the woman who put her Pekingese up on the fence to get a better look at the alligator, and it fell in, and that was actually a big scandal in the 30s in the
Oh
Times.
my God.
There's an ad saying, you know, a $400 reward for you know for, what was it for something about you know if you can find the woman who's peeking is something. It was a huge thing. Anyway, he dies. His wife doesn't want it. She sells the stock to the Florida Wildlife Ranch, by the way, and sold the whole thing. And it just sat there. Different people lived in it. Boom, gone. But by 1943, there was no trace of it at all. That's how old this thing was. You know, I like things that happened maybe 20 years ago, where you can find really good stories in the old newspapers about it. I can find great archival stuff at the Museum of History. Maybe people who were still alive who were around then. I found the architect who designed the old Penguin Restaurant, the hurricane proof Penguin Restaurant, which is in this new book. The architect's still alive, and he told me how they did it, and he told me why they did it. If you remember, it looked like a big white igloo out there
When
on
was that? When was that?
The Penguin
Yeah, where
out
was
there.
that?
It's where the Treasure Island Beach Pavilion is now on Sunset Beach. It was
Oh my gosh, yes, you're right.
yeah
Okay,
okay
got it.
and there's I've got incredible pictures of it in this. Well, I kept getting knocked down by, oh, the story, if you'll allow me, the story of that place. It started in the late 30s as a private club for doctors, lawyers, and, you know, the moneyed who, you know, would winter here. And they played cards, and they had water sports out and back, right? It's very near the end of Sunset Beach there. The proprietor and his wife were the parents of Terrence McNally, the Pulitzer Prize winning playwright.
Yes.
He was their 3-year-old son. Actually, he was born here, and they had a house on Sunset Beach.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you go on the old society pages of the Times, they would say, we had a wonderful time at the Penguin Club. And young Terry, Terry O'Nally was crawling around on the floor to the delight of all the ladies from Minnesota, you know. And so anyway, over the years, it became a restaurant, different things, and it kept getting knocked over by hurricanes. So in the early 70s, the guy that owned it at the time, after the big blow of 72, I think it was, he says, I'm going to build something that's hurricane-proof. And he'd heard about these buildings in, I think, Jamaica, where they sprayed like liquid fiberglass over a steel frame. And it was literally like a big stone igloo. And he hired this architect, Ron Ginn, who's still around, to design it and find out how to do it. And that's what they did. And so this thing withstood every hurricane for years and years. It became a lesbian nightclub called Bedrocks.
Yes. Okay. This is Bedrocks.
Okay. And they painted it pink. I have a picture.
Yeah. I do know Bedrocks. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And that was
like,
the old
it looked like the Flintstones.
It looks it does. Yeah. And it had this whole line of portholes looking out over the Gulf of Mexico. Very bizarre place. It was a great, in this, listen, man, in the 70s, it was a cool date place. You know, they had like great prime rib, and the guy cut it on a little motorized cart, came to your table, and it was swanky inside. It looks really stupid outside, but it was swanky. Anyway, Bedrocks, they ran out of money. They sold it to the city, and the city knocked it down and put up, the beach pavilion that they don't seem to maintain too well, Treasure Island. anyway. So that's they come out of everywhere, these stories. They do.
What advice would you give like a young person that was wanting to do kind of follow in your footsteps?
Read. Always read. Read. You know, I started as a music journalist, and the only way I knew anything was to read Cream and Crawdaddy and Musician. And thank God, I don't have to say this anymore, but Rolling Stone, when Rolling Stone was cool. Because it sure ain't anymore. But, you know, I think I probably stole a lot of stylistic things, but I certainly learned how to do that kind of writing and not be boring about it. You know, write what you know, and if you get into writing about the city council, learn about the city council. You know, if you're going to be a journalist, that's what I was saying before. If you're going to be a beat reporter, you have to pretty much know everything about it before you touch a key on your keyboard. Otherwise, you're just a faker. What are you doing this for? That's what I would tell a young person starting out. Just read, you know your subject, read, and follow your bliss, you know, follow your passion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Take those anxiety pills. Yeah. Because it'll happen.
Okay. my coughing's kicking in. Hold on.
Uh-oh. Here we go. You got some water over there?
I do, but let's hear some of your writing. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm gonna read you a section from one of the chapters from volume 3, if that's all right.
Yes, please.
This is the chapter called The Beaux-Arts Gallery and Coffee House. And we'll start here. Tom Reese told the author of On the Road to hit the road. Legendary beat novelist Jack Kerouac, living out the last alcoholic years of his life in mid-1960s St. Petersburg, was known to frequent the Beaux-Arts Gallery and Coffee House, the ramshackle bohemian outpost Reese operated next to the North-South Railroad tracks in Pinellas Park. Kerouac would sit in the back of the dark, high-ceilinged room smelling of mildew and stuffed helter-skelter with stained easy chairs and ratty sofas and listen to the poets and the folk singers. The writer was known to carry a flask of bourbon in his jacket pocket. Tom knew damn well who Kerouac was, recalls musician John Balcom, who lived for a time upstairs in one of the Beaux-Arts rooms for rent. Reese told him the story a dozen times, maybe 100. And Kerouac really appreciated Tom because the Beaux-Arts was a little bit of San Francisco right there in St. Petersburg, just a conservative retirement town at that time. But for all the creative freedoms allowed and encouraged at 7711 60th Street North, butting up against the Pinellas Park police station, Reese maintained a handful of ironclad rules. According to Balcom, Kerouac was usually too loaded to do his own poetry, or maybe he didn't want to do it. But the last time, Tom escorted him to the door and threw him out. He said, I don't put up with people drinking in my establishment. Do you want to hear more, or I can stop
Yeah,
there?
keep going. This is good.
Okay, pause. Thomas Bruce Reese, 1917 through 2006, was eccentric, opinionated, fiery, driven, and openly gay. He was also a man of eclectic tastes and extreme talents, an accomplished painter with a BFA from Stetson University and an MFA from California College of the Arts, a journalist who wrote art criticism, a published poet, and a dancer who'd performed with Ted Shawn's world-renowned all-male company. He was a Renaissance man who pointed the arts in Pinellas County toward its future. A Navy postmaster during World War II, Reese had immersed himself in the art, theater, and dance scenes of several large European cities, working and studying. He was also a voracious reader. It was 1950 when Reese returned to Pinellas Park, where he'd lived with his mother since the age of four. He took a job as a mail carrier for the town. Tom and Mother lived in a small house behind the Royal Palm Hotel, built in 1911 by his uncle Howard. She inherited the property, the tin-roofed hotel, the house, and the garden, when her brother-in-law died. Reese immediately set about turning the old clapboard structure into the launching pad of his dream, a progressive art gallery and an art school. There was to be nothing like it in the area. His co-founders at the Contemporary Art Gallery and College included sculptress Maybelle Muttart Faldereau and painters David Anderson, Ted Powell, and Sidney Stein. Among other accomplishments, Stein had designed the classic circus train box for Animal Crackers and the bright red packaging for Ritz Crackers. Although Reese and the artists in his orbit continued to give art lessons for much of the 50s, the original plan didn't pan. Students on the GI Bill were precluded from attending his art school, explained San Francisco artist Marie Eliza, who knew Reese later in his life. That basically killed it for him, so he had to switch from what he wanted to do to something else. And so the poetry readings and the folk singers' nights in the main gallery room or outdoors in the garden. Art contests were regularly scheduled and proved extremely popular with the locals, with regional and even national artists. He turned another downstairs section of the Royal Palm into the movie room, where he programmed foreign experimental avant-garde films. Maria Eliza was a Tampa teen, disheartened by what she perceived as the universal conformity of her peers, and she wholeheartedly was uninterested in the pop music on the radio. When she was introduced to the coffee house crowd, she says, "I felt really comfortable with the people. I didn't know how weird I was until I discovered people who were weirder than I was. I started going there on a really regular basis. For free spirits, there was only one place to go. It was most likely the fall of 1961 when Jim Morrison, still 6 years away from stardom as the charismatic frontman for the Doors, wandered into the Contemporary Art Gallery and Coffee House. A student at St. Petersburg Junior College, the scruffy Morrison was obsessed with the poetry of Rimbaud and the writings of Nietzsche and others who questioned the accepted way of things. He was also a big fan of Jack Kerouac's, but it's unlikely the two ever crossed paths. According to Reese, and he told this story to anyone who would listen, Morrison, 17 or 18, got on stage and read his own poetry with his back to the audience on numerous occasions. Reese's friends insist he asserted great influence on the future rock star. Tom would explode on people, recalls Balcom, and that's what Morrison was copying on the dramatic parts of his Doors records, where he would go from singing to screaming. Tom infused him with a lot of theatrical stuff. There was something else, according to Pinellas Park artist and longtime Reese confidant Boo Ursum. Tom advised him he should keep his junk on the outside of his underwear, under his pants, to get more attention.
Oh, my God.
That's the first part of the story. It gets more bizarre as it goes
so
on.
So cool, though, that you, like, really capture, like, why this is such a special place. And there's
you know, so many creative Maureen, the Beaux Arts was the first place I ever got up on stage with a guitar and sang Buffalo Springfield songs. I was 14. And so I remember cool. Tom Reese very well. He scared the hell out of me. But the place was so cool.
I love that you brought in Jim Morrison, and I could just hear his songs and, like, his explosive.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, so well, cool. Tom Reese was an unapologetic name dropper and a celebrity hound. You know, when Marilyn Monroe and Joe DiMaggio were here, she had somebody drive her to the Beaux Arts where she bought a painting, And he told anybody who would listen, "Have I told you this story about Marilyn Monroe?" Every time, the Morrison story, that was legend. If you met him for 5 minutes, you heard that story.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. Thanks for all the
Hey,
advice.
I've had a great time. I wish
Thank
that
you.
I wish that you know, Creative Pinellas or the Arts Alliance would erect a statue to Tom Reese. This, you know, this was the first art gallery in Pinellas County.
Sounds like you need to create this reality, just like you got the memorial up for the Skyway victims.
Well, you know, maybe so. I mean, a lot of people remember Tom, and a lot of people thought he was super weird, which he was, but he did a lot of good for this town. Nobody else was doing this stuff.
I love it. Well, that can be your 2024 mission there.
Maybe so. I mean, we'll get a statue put up of him. Well, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for tuning into Typewriter Talks. If you want to know more about Keep St. Pete Lit, you can go to keepstpetelit.org. All of the past episodes are on our website. And if you like what you hear, please consider donating to help. We are a nonprofit, and to support this programming going forward. And please tune in next week. We drop a new episode every Thursday, as long as my voice holds out. But we appreciate you, Bill. Keep being you. Keep writing.
Oh, we appreciate you too, Mo. It's always a pleasure. I think I told you I saw your mom a couple of days ago. And hey, Kathleen.
Yeah, she told me she went to your book release.
Yeah, that's right. We did a Kwanis. She was at the Kwanis thing. Yeah.
Like, can you come? Fun. And I'm like, it's before noon. No, I mean, I love
it. It was tough for me, man. Believe me.
Yeah, that's my writing time. That's my.
Yeah, I'm usually just here with my coffee editing and you know, coffee and the cats.
I get
it. Anyway,
well, thank you. All right. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next week. And please continue to read and write on.
Typewriter Talks features interviews with writers, poets, and other bookish folks. It is hosted by Maureen McDowell, founder and executive director of Keep St. Pete Lit, which is a literary arts organization based in St. Petersburg, Florida. Listen in to hear discussions on all kinds of writerly topics. Our goal is to show you that there is not one right way to be a writer. Learn more about Keep St. Pete Lit at www.keepstpetelit.org.